excelente.
But you know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Every you do, don't fall.
Sometimes when we do the big hitter series, I do venture away from like the movies, and what I do is I bring up important television events that took place. And what a wonderful coincidence it is that I've become friendly with author Paul Terry. Why have I become friendly with this guy? Well, because we did our cold check chat around about a year ago from now. And I mentioned then that I was obsessed with his Lost Encyclopedia book that he co-wrote, and that I'd just gotten hold of the X-Files official archives book that he'd put out, and I loved it just as much. So, that being said, I then asked him that as 1994 marked the second season run of that legendary TV series, if he'd like to come on the show and maybe chat about his book and also the importance of season 2 to the X-Files franchise. Well, I didn't have to twist his arm very hard at all, because he was very much up for it, because obviously this guy is obsessed. He wrote the book on the thing. So this is our chat, and I would have to say right now, just please stick around to the end, because I've got an announcement to make that's quite pertinent to this very conversation. Please welcome to the show Mr. Paul Terry. By 1994, X-Files mania was in full swing. Season 2 had just been commissioned, and its release at the back end of the year, it turned me into an addict for the show, full stop. I love that general overarching mythos of the show, the UFOs, the abduction stuff, the smoking man and his mysterious agenda. Plus, those Monster of the Week episodes, they were a genuine thrill as well at the time, and I'm sure for most of you that watched it in your youth, a lot of the creatures in those probably traumatized you for years. This one is for us. So today we have the return of author Paul Terry. Just one more appearance and that's officially a regular guest. Now, I clearly love this chat. I hope you enjoy it.
We wanted to believe. We wanted to call out. On August 20th and September 5th, 1977, two spacecraft were launched from the Kennedy Space Flight Center, Florida. They were called Voyager. Each one carries a message.
We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking
a gold-plated record depicting images, music, and sounds of our planet, arranged so that it may be understood if ever intercepted by a technologically mature extraterrestrial civilization.
Children of planet Earth.
13 years after its launch, Voyager 1 passed the orbital plane of Neptune and essentially left our solar system. Within that time, there were no further messages sent, nor are any planned. We wanted to listen. I wanted to believe, but the tools have been taken away. The X-Files have been shut down. They closed our eyes. Our voices have been silenced. Our ears now deaf to the realms of extreme possibilities.
I send greetings on behalf of the leader of our family.
$4 for the first hour of parking is criminal. What you got better be worth at least 45 minutes. It's dangerous for us just to have a little chat, Scully. We must assume we're being watched.
Agent Mulder.
Krycek. Alex Krycek.
Mulder, I haven't seen any indication.
No, of course not. These people are the best.
You know, back at the academy, some of the guys used to make fun of you. Well, some of us believed what you were doing because we knew there was more out there than they were telling us.
Mm-hmm.
authorize this investigation, Agent Mulder?
I'd assumed we had an understanding.
Save it for your report, because until this matter is cleared up, your investigation, official or otherwise, is terminated.
Your time is over. And you leave with nothing.
Trust no one.
Trust no one.
Terry, hello, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me on again, Paul.
Well, this is a bit of a dream one because I love covering these films and TV series and whatever with my friends. And now I've got a new friend and an author of a book that deals with the very subject that we are dealing with right now today. It's X-Files, and we're heading into season two. Because season two began in 1994, which is the year that we're covering. So, Paul, are you ready? Are you ready for this one?
I'm so ready. I can't wait to hear your reactions to episodes and mythologies and just get into some good nitty-gritty Mulder and Scully awesomeness. Let's do it.
Before we get into season two, having written a book about this, I would imagine you're quite the fan. So, where's your history begin with it? Like, we spoke, I think, on our very first conversation about, like, our little history with it, where I mentioned that I was actually in America on day one when it dropped. But then, of course, when you come back here, it wasn't out for a little bit. So, yeah, there was that issue. But, like, were you day one in the UK for this?
Oh, yeah. I can still remember it. I can still remember the countdown. There were these little teasers and things like, I think the Radio Times or the TV Times had sort of a teaser for what was coming to BBC and a couple of promos that were aired. And you've got to, I mean, so I think, yeah, season one for X-Files, I think the UK got it in 94. So we're always slightly behind. But of course, we're talking about the actual production of the show airing right. in the US. And so we are talking season two, which was September 94 and then went straight through to 95. So that's where we are for the show. But for me as a fan, yeah, cast your mind back to imagine like teenage Paul Terry, who already is obsessed with UFOs, alien mythology. I mean, there's no internet by this point, but I'm just like fascinated by the subject. Any documentary that comes on the telly on Channel 4, I'm like, oh, record that. And monsters, cryptids, anything of the unexplained. And then this show just seemingly comes out of nowhere and goes, hi, we're going to, here's a new drama that's going to crack your head open about, you know, that all those things and more. And my mum is a horror and like sci-fi fan. So I've got this great memory of us sitting down and watching the pilot together and just, you know, all the lights out. And it's such a dark show in terms of lighting, like the cinematography is really awesome and atmospheric and smoky. And that pilot just blew my mind. And then what was so fun was going to school after it aired, and then all your friends of like minds, the buzz was, did you watch X-Files? You look at X-Files? And you're, no, I taped it. I'm watching it tonight. We're going to talk about it. And so I've got this great memory of that alone.
I could just imagine, like, because the thing is, I'd come home, I'd spoken about it with friends, and then it sort of disappears. And then, of course, it becomes this pop culture phenomenon really quick. And it was one of those must-see TV things. Like, for me, growing up, it was the episodes of the A-Team and Street Hawk, of all things. Like, I just remember, like, that was, for my age, that was playground chatter. It was fantastic times. This is a bit later on where I'm speaking to people, like, having intelligent conversations about, like, could that happen? Is that potentially real? What was the one with the guys with the tattoo all over? It was the Jim Rose Circus Sideshow. Was that it? Am I remembering that correctly?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, that's season two. Yeah, we'll definitely be into that.
So, like, I remember that coming on, and it was already sort of big in pop culture at that time for us grungers as we were. And I just remember talking about it. And like, I remember Mark Arm mentioning it in an interview when he was talking for a Mudhoney interview. And he just mentioned that offhand. And it was like, oh God, like it's so zeitgeisty right now, right here. And I was in the middle of it. It was fantastic. And I didn't feel that again until Lost and then never since. So it's those two things, those two TV series that sort of shaped what I loved so much about, I hate to say cheapen it, but like junk culture, like pop culture, mm-hmm. like it's something that we can absorb ourselves in. Where do you go from loving this in such a way to thinking later on in adult life, not only do I still love this, but I'm going to find out if I can get commissioned, write a book? Or did you just write a book and say, look, here's what I've done? What do you think?
It's one of those kind of pinch me moments where I had this idea rattling around for a long time, just as a fan. So, you know, I watched the whole of the show and it sort of closes out season 9 around the early 2000s. There's a bit of a gap. And then there's the I Want to Believe movie, 2008, like, you know, a few years after that. But there was just always this idea as a fan. I had books and some tie-in comics and things, but it was, you know what I want as a fan? I want the X-Files. I want the files. I want the things that the show is about. I want the things they file for reports. I want to dig through those. And that idea, sort of, however it was buried in my head, when there was the announcement in 2015 of the show coming back, which again, who predicted this?
Yeah.
A season 10, 6-episode limited series event coming back in 2016. The day it was announced in 2015, I leapt on my email and pulled up my contact. I've got a few contacts, which was then 20th Century Fox, and just emailed and said, hey, just seen this announced. I have a concept for a book that I want to pitch. And the useful thing is I had worked with Fox before for other projects. So there was already like a relationship. There wasn't just some crazy fan going, excuse me, I'd like to write a book for you. So there was that professional playing field, which we met on. And the most delightful thing is my contact replied back within minutes and went, when we dropped the announcement, I was waiting to hear from you. There was something about, because she knew me and she knew what I loved. And the elevator pitch was, I think fans should have the X-Files themselves. And it took a second for the penny to drop. And then very quickly, sort of the principle of the idea, this is what we talk about in publishing. When the principle of the idea gets approved, it's like, yeah, that would be really cool. And then you get to another level where it's like, well, you know, Chris Carter, of course, has to approve it. It's his show and has to, you know, give it his blessing is the phrase, as the concept. And then comes the hard work, because then you have to find, it doesn't matter if a studio or even the creator of a show loves a concept for a book. You have to find a publisher who actually cares about it like you do. And that, my friend, is pretty hard. Because you think X-Files is perennially awesome and worldwide hit like we all think as fans. And because it is, the data's there to prove it. But let's just say, to be polite and not to throw anyone under any buses, this went to a few places. We'll just say that. Went to a few places with a really strong pitch, an outline of what it would be. And it got some ums and ahs and that's interesting. And then it had an almost, we'll sign you up in green like this, and then a pass. And this is years. This like goes on for years. And serendipity reigns, as she always does. And I was attached to the Marvel Studios book, my first one with the studio, with Tara Bennett, The Story of Marvel Studios. We started working on that in 2017 and went through to 2021. So that was a 4-year project. But the crucial thing is San Diego Comic-Con. So amazing. I believe it would have been the Comic-Con of 2018 was when they initially announced the book, and it had a slightly different title and a different angle initially for the Marvel book. But crucially, it was the first time I'd met face-to-face the editor of the book, Eric Kloffer, who's an awesome editor. And we was chatting, just getting to know each other. We'd spoken on the phone and stuff. And something in my head made me just throw this out. And I just said, do you like X-Files? And he literally just stopped and went, I'm obsessed with the X-Files. And it was that kind of reaction. I was like, ah. And he goes, why'd you ask? And I said, we're working on this book right now, but I've got this concept for a book that I've been shopping around. I'm trying to get a publisher to care about it. Told him what it was. And he literally just said, is it with anywhere right now? I said, no, there's just been some people pass on it. don't give it to anyone else. Where is it? Where's the pitch? And I was like, in my hotel room with my laptop. Just like, email me to me today. I tell you, it's one of the fastest, like, green light situations. Emailed him the pitch. I think it might have even been within weeks. It might have been only like a month or less than that. They wanted it. They grabbed it. Abrams went, yes, grabbed it, signed on. And we were away. We were flying. And then, you know, the project, as complex as it is, was, you know, 2.5 years roughly of putting it together. But I was so thrilled that they grabbed it, because Abrams was always supposed to be the home for this, because they absolutely knocked it out of the park. They really cared about it. They cared about the design. They cared about production values, making it like a really slick product. And it's meaty, it's heavy, you know, it's like a weapon.
Yeah. Yes.
And so could not be more proud to be with Abrams Books for these titles, because they just care about this stuff. And that's not me just like, you know, hey, you know, they're my publisher boss. It's genuine, because if you're a fan and you hold this book in your hands, you know I'm talking the truth. So that's the history of the, and it's a good lesson for anyone listening who's in the creative arts. It's like, don't think that a cold, cool pitch is not going to go somewhere. You know, have the courage of your convictions. If it's a good idea, you know, it has the potential to have legs and walk somewhere, but it might take some years. So it's a marathon. It's not a sprint, this game.
I need to ask you several questions about this. I'm going to begin with, because the look of the book and the way it is, like you've mentioned, it's the actual files. Did you have any mock-up pages within this pitch to show them, like, this is the sort of thing that I want? Was anything complete yet for you?
Nothing complete at all. It was literally the strength of, I think, the idea, which hooked people's imagination. And, you know, we've seen these procedural shows, these FBI shows, cop shows, where you do see some paperwork. You see some paper props passed around on camera. And I think it was just that sense, like the sense of, oh my goodness, of course, yeah, they file reports all the time. It's case closed, or it's case, you know, case is still open and it's pending or whatever it is. And it's going to have the written document from Mulder and Scully, and whatever supportive visual evidence will be attached or part of the report. So I think it was, people could see it. And oftentimes, I think with a great idea, a great book idea, if you can make someone else see it in their mind, I guess it's like a movie. If you can make someone see it, they're like, I want to see that movie. I want to, here's some dollars to make the movie. So yeah, there was literally nothing mocked up. But the cool thing was, once it was greenlit and once I had arranged access to the archives, the actual 20th Century Fox archives, to go into the real archives, that's where the fun begins, because you're eventually wading through actual paper props and physical props from the show that literally haven't seen oxygen for, in some cases, for 20, 25 years.
Rewind. No, you're not going on. I need to know more. Like, so what the hell is it, this vault? Tell me.
Okay. So every studio naturally has really awesome archiving areas. Temperature controlled, very secure, because this is their legacy. You know, this goes back, it's 100 years of cinema. So, you know, it goes back to film props. And then when the TV revelation happened, all of the TV props. And yes, stuff gets sold from time to time. But for the most part, especially for the hit shows, they're very, very good at archiving, as it sounds, the props, items, costumes, paper props. They're all carefully put away. But the great thing is about this project is that I'm like, well, the book's going to be called The X-Files, The Official Archives, because that was the hook. We were going to have it as a paper-bound physical copy. And so fans listening who are curious about how this even worked, the angle was, and we'll get to that a little bit later, but the angle was digital versions of things can always be manipulated. I think we're ahead of our game a little bit about fake news things, right. But it can always be manipulated. But if you have a physical-bound archive compendium of those reports, you can't fake that, because you could literally scientifically date the paper, date the ink, because I know this is actually the truth. So our hook was the book project that's a completely in-world book, that's it's a real physical artifact, that it's preserving the truth. That was the hook of it. So any nefarious forces preserve the truth. So the real archives for the studio, they're incredible. And it's really tricky as a fan when you're on the clock, you literally have, you can't sit in there for months on end. You have limited time, batches of time to be poring over this stuff, finding what you need for a project. And because I knew this first book was going to be essentially a lot of the Monsters of the Week episodes. So we were staying away from the alien mythology, extraterrestrial mythology, the conspiracy stuff. For a bunch of reasons, this was the right book to come out with out the gate with this concept. But I'm going through stuff and I'm finding stuff that's incredible. I'm finding stuff that I wasn't expecting to find. And then I'm finding stuff from episodes I know I'm not going to cover. But in my mind's eye, I'm thinking, well, if this book works, maybe they want to do more. So I'm banking what they have and writing that down. So just crazy. You can't even imagine it as a fan. You know, I'm fanboying out, but also I'm trying to be professional and just get through this and log everything. Incredible team there. They really love their job. They really care about this stuff. And what I didn't realize until in the thick of this first volume was that kind of like relationship where you see their enthusiasm. They're going, oh, we're going to high-res scan this document that literally, say, hasn't seen light for 20 years. And it's going to be forever preserved in a book that's an in-world book. So fun all round. A lot of hard work, but fun all round.
Okay. So... again, sorry. my wife works in archives in Canterbury Uni, and she she deals with UK comedy and UK cartoonists from I think 1900 onwards.
Oh,
so
my God.
A lot to deal with, and when she digitally archives these things, the cameras cost more than my house. Like it's insane what the equipment that they're dealing with. So is that the sort of thing you were doing? Were you like having professional photos done for knowing that they're going to be included in the book? Or were you just logging, I need this, I need that, I need that, and then hopefully they would do the right thing?
100%. It's exactly the same process as your wife's job. So basically, you know, the white gloves are on and you are handling stuff. You can't damage it. And I'm making, you know, different piles. If it's the paper products, we're putting the paper props with, you know, separators between them, and I'm going, so I need this scanned at 1-to-1 scale. And then if it's small props, it's like, well, this prop will be photographed as though it is FBI evidence, like it's an evidentiary photo, so that I need that photographed against like a white background. But yeah, it's logging everything in the context, and this is what I love about this kind of book. So in-world books are super fun because you basically have to create the right context, and I'm really hard on myself for the rules of the book. So every report in this X-Files book has to make sense. So Mulder and Scully can only report on what they encountered. You can't have, you know, if there's B stories or other character experience things, you've got to watch the show when you're researching a book like this to write it with a completely different viewpoint. You're not really watching it as a fan. You're watching it in a meta way as an investigator. So you're tracking what the agents are actually experiencing. And then you're thinking about events that you have to feature, but maybe it's from a security camera. Maybe you have a shot of a cryptid or whatever, but you know that there were cameras in that region. A security camera caught this shot. Right. And then you can tell the designer, that's how we'll get away with it, essentially, of having the fans enjoy having this glimpse of the cryptid.
Yeah.
But it makes sense because it was in the city or whatever. But you... So you're kind of balancing many, many ideas at the same time, but with the same goal, which is always be true to the show, let the show lead it, and just don't cheat the logic of anything. So that it's fun, but a lot of pressure on yourself to not mess up those rules, but really cool.
As a fan, like, I thought I would be in safe hands because, as I've mentioned to you before, I had that Lost Encyclopedia, which is a book I loved going to.
Oh, thank you.
So... when I got this, I was like, because there's so many places that you could potentially go wrong. And you know what made me feel like, oh my word, like I'm in safe hands here? It was because you took into account the fire that happened later on. So there was various documents that you could only see a bit of because they were burnt, that rescued, or some missing completely because I'm afraid there was a fire and it was lost. And then another bit that just like, oh, God, you're good, is when there's a bit from Scully where she took it because this case was personal to her. So this is her file that we've got complete. And that's how you made it in world. It's so clever and so simple when you think about it. But as a fan, you're like, oh, okay. So this is all in world. You're not taking me out of it. You're not. I just watched the end of season two last night, and it felt like, when it comes into season three, it felt almost like a little bit of a cop out to me, and I hate that sort of thing on a cliffhanger, because Mulder ended up okay and I didn't buy how he got out there. But it doesn't happen within this book. Everything feels like, yep, that makes sense, that's why that's there. So I'm just, as a fan, thank you, well done for taking it so seriously.
Well, there's no greater compliment than that. And thank you for seeing those details, because this was my favourite thing about putting together these books. And so this first one, the emotionality of the characters and the journey is, for me, is everything about the show. I mean, we'll dig into the Mulder and Scully relationship, I'm sure, a lot with the season two chat. But for the book, you know, I wanted to thread that needle of, yes, there is a kind of coldness to a report. There are professional FBI agents, you know, they're special agents, they have a job to do. But within that sort of guardrails, you have to be thinking about, these are real characters. These are real, ostensibly real people. They experience a lot of heavy emotions on this show. And so wherever there's an opportunity to give a little glimpse of something that is a nod towards what they're experiencing personally, or even the tiniest nod to a relationship situation with the pair of them, you know, I say we'll get to season two in a second, but you know, when Scully is gone and we're looking at the Trinity Murders episode, the vampire one in season two, you as a writer, you can't ignore the fact that what Mulder's going through, you can't ignore the fact that how he would be even in his report. So he's not going to be, you know, doing a confessional and gushing about stuff, but he's going to be reminding his superiors what his focus is, where his head's at, that he's not sleeping. Because it also is, it's a professional statement to make. If you're going through some kind of traumatic event, yeah, you're going to address that in a very subtle way. So they were my favorite challenges to really, of course, learn and capture Mulder and Scully's differences and how they speak as characters. And then you've got to distill that into how would they write a report. So you've got little flourishes of how Mulder talks, flourishes of how Scully talks, but you must track, I think, if you get one of these books, you must track where they're at emotionally in the story for doing the report. So you saying all that is literally the greatest review. If a fan responds like that, and if you can get a sense of that I really cared about this project and it wasn't just write me a book on the X-Files,
yeah,
thank you so much. I love that. I will drink my tea and salute you.
I love it. Yeah, so as I say, genuinely excited going through this. I've had a good couple of days, to be honest, because as I say, I finished season two. My wife's been really absorbed with it as well. I felt young again watching it again, because it does. This is so nostalgic to see them two working together. And like, I felt like you were writing in their voice, and it just really worked. And like, what I would like to say before we leave this, there's two things that are remarkable to me. And the first one, you've mentioned it already, but the quality of this book, when you received that, I mean, you must have been like, what the hell is this? Like, you can't have imagined it be that good. Like, with the little embossing and the thickness of the actual the binding and everything, it would just, I've never seen anything like it.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, because, well, first of all, to go back slightly, I knew that the book and the project and me were in great hands with the design team, because Paul Keppel, Head Case Design, from the get-go, they were all in. I'd seen their previous work, and their previous work is all about excruciating detail and being faithful to eras and periods and exact periods of time. So when we had our initial chats about the design, and I was talking about, because again, you can't expect a designer to binge watch, you know, 200 episodes of a show to get a sense of the show. You have to guide them. And he knew the show, but it's like guiding them through the minutia. Because as you say, the minutia is where you're going to land a concept like this as a book. So I was saying, well, you know, we're going to have, when you're going through the 90s, but we also have things you're going to see from the 50s. So I want there to feel like the fonts are accurate to those periods of time. I want the paper to be accurate, the spacing in the typing to be accurate to those periods. Because fonts are a really interesting thing. I could talk for an hour about fonts, but there was a natural kind of evolution. And if you look at this book, as you go from the 90s to the 2000s, there's just a natural change in what fonts are popular to use in office work and filing. So you really, as a fan, you also travel through time a little bit in how the typesetting is through the reports. And Paul Keppel was just all on board for that from the get-go, going, yep, that's exactly what we want to do. And in the back and forth of the design, he would contribute an idea for something to boost a section, or Paul, can you do like a, what about a police blotter? Is there an opportunity to do that for this episode? I'm thinking, actually, there would be an opportunity. That will just give it a little bit of zhuzh on this page.
Yes.
So the back and forth was incredibly detailed, incredibly nerdy. And I can say this to the listeners, that if you see this book, every square inch of every single page has been considered as to how it works and functions, to take you through as you almost become an investigator as a reader. You are studying the reports. So that was a really crucial thing for us, to take the reader really deep inside the book. But you're 100% right. Seeing the final book, the final product, if we remember, 2020 was a kind of weird year, to say the least. And the book came out in, I believe, September 2020. And so for a number of reasons, I couldn't get an advanced copy to me. The first time I saw the book, the real thing, was a closed shop in-store signing, all masked up, that I did Dark Delicacies in Burbank, an amazing horror store, horror and bookstore. And there were all these piles and piles of pre-orders all on the desk ready for me to sign. And I said to Del and Sue, the owners, I said, can I just have a couple of minutes, because I haven't seen this? And they went, oh my God, you've not even seen the book? I went, no, I've not seen it. So I cracked open the cellophane and just looked at it. And, you know, the smell of a new book, but the weight of it was incredible. The production values were incredible. And although I'd seen on a screen and signed off, you know, the look of each page, you're right. Seeing it in person, the thickness of the paper stock, the scale of it, the embossing, and all the tricks that were done, I was just so thrilled that the journey of the book from 2015 had led to Abrams, led to them caring about it this much, because also, you know, the fandom deserves that. The fandom deserves a book like this. If you're going to do it, you've got to, you know, the X-Files show is such a high quality show. Every single department kills it. Like, no one faxes anything on the X-Files. Every department smashes it out of the park. So you feel that pressure that you have to do that. And I felt like the publisher knew that. The publisher were like, no, this is the X-Files. This is like TV royalty. We can't just give you some crappy paperback. So thrilled. So thrilled with how it turned out.
Wow. Do you know what? I'm so happy for you that it turned out like it did. And before we go into actual talking about season two, I understand there's plans for another book.
Yes.
Is there anything you can reveal?
I can tease a little bit. I can say that I can say it will be out soon. I can tell you that it is volume two of the X-Files, the official archives, and its subhead is, well, backtrack slightly. So volume one, the tongue twist of subhead, which I'm so pleased they agreed to do, because I love how long it is. It's cryptids, biological anomalies, and parapsychic phenomena. Because I think, there you go, there's an X-Files title. The second book is entitled Extraterrestrial Activity and the Syndicate. So if you hear that and you think, oh, now we're pivoting to the mythology of the show, what I can tease is that this second volume is the entire mythology of the show, from season one to the end of season 11. No stone is left unturned. If you're looking at experiencing the X-Files reports, and I'll just tease and say, and some other strangeness and immersive qualities that you love about the mythology and just the mystery of that, and being engaged with the mystery, I promise you, everyone is working incredibly hard to land it, so that you feel that way about it, the same way you did about volume one. I'm kind of more excited about volume two. I'm so thrilled with volume one, but I'm even more excited about how the fans are going to respond to volume two. So stick around, keep an eye out for updates on pre-orders and things like that, but it's coming soon.
I am fascinated. I can't wait. I hope you lot listening out there, like, we're into that sort of nerdy take on this book. If you've got the book or you're thinking of getting it, I hope that really helps with regards to like helping you along with your journey. Because, like, as I say, I find every single thing we've talked about fascinating. Thank you for coming on and talking about it, because it's so rare that I get heavily stuck into a book. And you might think, oh, if it's just the files, it's not going to be very prose heavy. But there's loads to read. There's loads to get into. And I even love the way you finish the whole thing, like, because you would not, looking at it, he's like, well, but there's no mention of like who's written this and like the real world. This is all X-Files world. And then when you get to the very back page, there it is, and all the thanks and everything. But it's still done like a report with blacked out sections and things like that that we're not allowed to see as readers. I love it. Like, so good.
Thank you.
You're
man.
Such a fool. I love it.
No, thank you so much. And yeah, I can promise the fans that from the cover to the very end, this is an entirely in-world project. And if you're curious who is putting together the files, if you're a super fan, you will know the phrase Agent Layla Harrison. I'll just leave that there. If you don't know who Layla Harrison is, I promise you there is a task that is suggested that she gets involved with from Walter Skinner himself at the very beginning of the book. And the concept and the angle as to why she's doing this is totally tied into the mythos of the show, including the later season. So this is, it's 100% buttoned up in world. So dive in, enjoy.
Love it. Okay, let's get into it. Season two. Now, I've broken this up into two separate things here. So we're talking about, first of all, the Monster of the Week episodes, and we'll go through your favourites and what you think this one brought to the table that season one maybe didn't. And then we're going to go into the mythology afterwards. Yeah, let's just leave it at that. So let's begin Monster of the Week, season two. One of my very favourite, I think I say one of, my actual very favourite episode is amongst them. It's, and I don't even know how to pronounce it. These titles, by the way, from season two, stop it. Like, it's ridiculous. So we've got Die Hand, Die Valets, is it?
I studied a wee bit of German at school. I think it's close. I think it's Die Hand, Die Valets. It's always D, but it's great you've called that out, because ahead of our chat, I did my homework and I wrote down my faves, and it's one of two faves. So you take it away first on that one, and we'll circle back.
Well, being such a horror fan, like, I remember when this one came out, and I was just on edge the whole time. My horror experience was not as vast as it is now from doing this show. So it felt like a contained horror film for me. And the supply teacher, Mrs. Paddock, and I've written her name, Suzanne Blumhardt, going to say, she played her, and she was so excellent and so scary. And there was that split second where she's got the black eyes and everything. X-Files always touched on horror. There are episodes where you think, well, that's a when you say a monster of the week, it really was like a monster movie it contained. But this one just, it felt evil and nasty. And like, even when they're quite flippant at the front of it, when it starts raining frogs and it's quite jovial, it doesn't last like that long in its temperament. It quickly gets quite spooky molder. Yeah, so do you know anything that I don't know or fans might not know about that episode? And why would it be one of your faves as well?
I think for the reasons you described, it's also a favourite of mine. I feel like the placement of this episode is really crucial for why it works so well. I'll hint at another episode that I want to dig into and talk about as far as the Monster of the Week, which is the preceding episode, which is called Irresistible. So I feel like episode 13 into this episode 14 of Die Hand, Die Valets is an ingenious move for the show. Die Hand is, as you say, it is genuinely terrifying. Evil has the upper hand the whole time. Like, your preconceived notions of a supernatural show, a paranormal investigation show, where you, by this point, you know Mulder and Scully pretty well if you've watched all season one and you're halfway through season two. The idea that they're not going to win. You feel it. You feel the episode. Like, how are they going to? They can't just vanquish this. And I felt like that really raises the stakes for all the characters, because they think, you know, even if they get close to the money, which they do, as solving the kind of mystery behind the crimes and what's really occurring, I can't stop it. And I think that gave it this really palpable sort of ick, like you say. But what I really love about the menace of that was balanced with this really self-aware attitude, which I really, you got to hand it to Glenn Morgan and James Wong, the writers, because they were known pretty quickly on the show for being those writers who could just balance some humor, some self-awareness, some satire with really pushing the envelope for storytelling. I especially love the fact that, you know, the cold open begins and you go, oh, you're already telling us that there are these devil worshipping teachers and parents of the town. Great. Oh, where do we go from here? And I love the fact that it shows its hand. And as I say, as a horror fan, that's a real horror trope to have devil worship in a small town, to show their hand immediately before even the titles have started. But then you have the satanic panic kind of being upended, because there are these kids that are, you know, horny teens who were admitting to Mulder and Scully, well, I was getting those books out because I was just trying to get some, you know, literally saying those lines. And then you have the kind of pretend satanic panic and morality issues of the town against, you know, what's affecting these teens and what's turning them to the dark side. And you're screaming going, it's you guys, it's not the kids. So I really love how that was balanced. But as you say, the whole thing is thwarted by this ever-present menace of and feeling of evil that as a viewer you take a while to latch on to the Mrs. Paddock of it all, Phyllis Paddock, and that's great as well. It's really clever movement of the story in the scenes. And then when we do twig, we know that, okay, well, that's not who we expected. But then you think immediately, if she has all these powers and is, you know, tapping into some devilry, can they stop it, or can they even just capture her? And you know, if we get into spoilers,
by all means, we can.
It is, yeah. It's been like 30 years, isn't it? It's such a great ending. The fact that as a pair of writers to land it with that cheeky ending, where she basically Mrs. Paddock writes on the chalkboard something along the lines of, you know, goodbye. Like that was fun playing with you, or fun knowing you, to Mulder and Scully. But it's their performance at the end of the episode where you really feel the power of the evil in the episode, because they know it. Even you know, Mulder being more paranormal leaning and Scully being more skeptical leaning, there's like this feeling of, yeah, let's not talk about what went down. This is too much.
Well, you mentioned the placement of where the episode is in the series, and I wonder if a couple of these episodes were moved around a little bit from like the timeline, because there's a specific timeline of where both Mulder and Scully are in this. They've both got their own personal things going on. And these Monster of the Week episodes sometimes will reference it in just passing, and then sometimes completely not. So I feel like they could juggle them, not like Lost, where, you know, it would be really, if you did that with Lost, like, whoa, what have you done there? That's completely, who are these people, you know? But I think that you could get away with that a little bit with X-Files. Do you know if there's any of that going on?
You know what? It's a really good question. Off the top of my head, I can't remember whether this one was originally planned earlier or later in the season. Perhaps it was a little later. It's just a total guess, because you say there's things you have to land and you can't really ignore about, even just where they're at as characters. But yeah, if we pivot to Irresistible in a second, there's a reason why I love the pairing of those two episodes together, as frightening as they both are.
Well, before we get into Irresistible, is that the one, I think it was that the one where in your book there's a receipt for Scully's car hire?
I think it might, I haven't got the book in front of me. I'm in volume two mode in my head right now. I believe it might be. Yes, there's a full blown car receipt hire that they just reproduced beautifully, which is like one of my favorite.
It's magic.
Like, it's so great.
Why would Dick, who would think of something like that? Like, but
this,
yeah, she goes
this
on a
crazy
road trip.
Guy.
there's a receipt. It's your proof. She did that.
Yeah,
well done. You're, as I say, you're a fool, and I love it. Okay, Irresistible. Now, this, again, is a creepy one, but not with, like, your traditional horror. It's more like that mind thing. We're going Lynchian, we're going to Cronenberg, staying away from body horror, but we're going to use Cronenberg sort of messing with your mind stuff. And, like, I've watched this one with Claire, And we were both freaked out by it. And so many years later, like, I was 19 when I first watched these, and I don't really remember this one at all. So it didn't stay with me over the years, whereas the next one I did. Tell me about this. What is it as an adult really got to me and Claire? What was it?
I think Irresistible does that really unusual trick of the Monster of the Week episode is, for some interpretations of it, you could just say he's just a guy. Like, the most monstrous, most horrific thing is human, is a human, a normal human serial killer, which is probably the most terrifying thing. Cryptids and monsters aside, if there's a person who is that dark and that evil in his abductions and his fetishes, is so grim and it's so frightening that he could just be walking among you and be doing all these horrendous things. I think that's the psychology of how affecting this episode was. But what I really appreciated about it was, being the X-Files, there are these flourishes and little glimpses of potentially a supernatural analysis of what's happening. And we get that, and we address it in the first book, actually, of the Archives, where it's a scene that not many fans remember strongly, because fans do love this episode. It's a really successful piece of storytelling. It's really frightening. It's really gripping from a character standpoint for Mulder and Scully too. But earlier in the episode, there is a scene where I think it's a man of the cloth. He thinks he catches a glimpse of this kind of demonic form for a split second that is Donnie Faster in his place, in his presence. And for me, that was the greatest kind of like evidence, especially in writing the report for the book, that it wasn't just, a lot of fans interpret Scully's trauma as imprinting something hellish on Donnie Faster's figure.
Right.
But someone else saw it. And, you know, putting cop mode on. And I am logic cop a lot, which I think is a good thing to be. It's like, no, someone else saw it. So it's like, if it was just all from Scully's perspective, but a completely innocuous random character we're shown on the show does see this demonic form where Donnie's standing. So that's the rub of the episode. It's like, is this something demonic at play, or is it just a human serial killer? But the reason why it's such a powerful episode for me as a fan is, we're only talking 5 episodes after Scully's returned, after being missing for a while, like with her abduction from the Dwayne Barry saga. And for me, the unthinkable happened as a fan. You know, you're barely recovered from poor Scully going through all this stuff and coming back to Mulder. Mulder's feeling really protective of her. And what's the worst thing you could ever imagine on a case like this, where he's targeting women? It's her being kidnapped and potentially murdered, like 5 episodes after the Dwayne Barry stuff.
Non-stop.
And I just love how Julian Anderson plays, she's always incredible in the show, but she plays all those beats so beautifully in this episode. She plays her faith being rattled. She plays at the trauma still bubbling away under the surface. She doesn't want to lean on Mulder. She doesn't want to show Mulder that she's still thinking about it. And then, say, the worst thing happens. The end of the episode, she Donnie Faster, you know, has her in his grasp. And it's such a small moment, but it's so powerful when Mulder does come in, does find her, and Donnie Faster's, you know, captured, and she's so vulnerable in his embrace. And you can see she starts to break down a little bit, but you see Mulder's expression is really powerful, where he's processing what just occurred so soon after Dwayne Barry. So again, it's probably, I'm showing my hand as to what I really love about this show, is that beyond the supernatural, beyond the paranormal, beyond the horror beats of the X-Files, there is no show, unless you have two parallel protagonists in Mulder and Scully, that you really care about. You care about their relationship with each other, and you want each of them to be all right. And the moment that one of them is threatened in any way, emotionally or physically, it's a problem. And as a fan, you're like, no, this can't be happening. So poor Scully, having this happen 5 episodes after the Dwayne Barry abduction, is unthinkable. But I think that's the power of the episode, that it happens relatively soon after it. And then going into DeHant, there's a lighter tone to it, but you still got the presence of evil. Irresistible is arguably a much more frightening and darker episode, because there's no humor in it whatsoever. There's no cheekiness at all. Sure. It's just a brutally, psychologically traumatizing episode. But then you need the little bit of the cheekiness that it, that DeHant has to follow it, even though it has a lot of oppression too. So that's why I love it as a 13 and 14 double act, if you want to watch two episodes back to back.
I think it's a great choice as well. I love that you brought up their current relationship where they are in this the moment in the series, because with her PTSD, she's not even sure why she's got it. She's not entirely focused on what happened. Obviously, she's thinking like of all the worst scenarios, but she doesn't know at this point. So she doesn't know why she feels like this. And the way that Mulder treats her, at first, I think he just ignores that she won't come and look at the bodies or whatever. Like, and it's okay. Like, I understand you've been through a lot. I'll deal with this. But then he says to her, you can trust me. Like, if you want to talk, I'm there. Doesn't pressure her or anything like that. And it took until the end of the episode. As you say, she's crying. We see as a fan that she's like, she's broken. And it's what's so good about this writing is it's realistic. Everything else might not be, but like her reaction and the way she actually breaks is within a split second, and it just gets her. It all becomes too much and she breaks and she cuddles him. What a moment. Like, what writing. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, you've nailed it 100%. I think that when anyone tries to, and many have tried in the world of TV and a film, I think, is to try and crack what is it about the X-Files that works so well, and why is it endured? Why does it still have fans talking about it all these years later? Of course, it is a combination of different factors. It's a magical equation. But if you don't have the Mulder and Scully characters written the way they're written, directed the way they're directed, but above, I would say, all of that, the casting of David and Jean as those characters, and even more crucial than the casting of them, their choices as creative people, as artists, in what they choose to do with those words, you've got a completely different show if you have all the same parameters, but then those two actors, for whatever reasons, make different choices in how their characters come across and how they react with one another. So I think that's the magic. And you can't, as I say, many have tried, you can't recreate that and say, oh, let's try and do like a Mulder and Scully type show, or maybe it's two Mulders, maybe it's two Scullies, or whatever it is. If it truly is, for lack of a better phrase, it is lightning in a bottle moment when all these factors come together. Because like you say, what if the writing was kind of under par and more of a kind of basic 5 out of 10 procedural FBI show that sure. Even if David and Gillian were exactly the same on making great choices with their lines, maybe it wouldn't land as well. But when you have the choices they make and the realism they bring to the scenarios, I think it's why X-Files could go as outlandish, in quotes, as it could with Paranormal and The Unexplained, because it always comes back to those two, the grounding, the realism of the performances. And then that echoes out to the entire cast. Everyone takes the stories, you know, for the most part, incredibly seriously, unless there is a deliberately heightened comedic episode, you know, so.
Yeah, and again, we don't, as fans, we don't mind them at all. Like, when they come along, that's fantastic. Like, give us that little bit of relief. Because we already trust those characters. We trust these writers. Bring it along. I think I never dropped out, but I think some of the later seasons, like, it was getting patchy with the episodes I enjoyed and the ones that I was like, I wish that, you know, move on and we'll get to the next one. But at this point in the series, like, I was going through them and like, I was like, oh, do you know what? Every one I've watched, I've really enjoyed. My wife wanted me to mention another one before we move on, and it's The Host. So for this, the fluke worm guy, if this freaked her out the most, then she said I had to mention it. So, Claire, I have. Now, in the book, this is the bit that I mentioned earlier on where we've got some records of it, but it's burnt. So we only get a bit of the records and things. And this is where I was like, oh, God, I love this. Like, it's so good because we just finished watching this episode. Now, this is, again, one of my favourite ones from this season. Take your mind back to when you first watched this. Like, if you can remember, because this is one that I just remember talking about with people afterwards. Like, when you watch it now, with technology moved on as much as it is, this is clearly a man in a suit. What do you feel like? Do you feel it like it still works?
I think so. I think that there's something about the special effects on this show, the visual effects were present as it moved on too, but most of the time, these were real physical effects that were used on the show. And I think the reason why the host monster that endures too, and it's so successful, is because I'm a huge monster fan, and I love it when a creature design can do the, it can thread the needle. Sorry, one second. Can you hear that sound outside? There's like a crazy semi coming down the street. As long as you can't hear it,
you're all
I'll
good.
Do a pickup. It's really, it's right behind my head. I'm like, what's going on? Thin windows. I'll do a pickup. So the reason why I think The Host is still successful today is because it threads that needle of, it's a humanoid form, but it's like just left of center, something uncomfortable. Yes. It's something that you look at and you go, well, it kind of is humanoid, but it's so disgusting and gross. And I can see with that, it's more, it wants to clamp onto me. I don't want that. I don't want to get anywhere near that. And I think that we have an inherent fear of parasites, of things that yes. latch on, be they microscopic or leeches. So I think that one of the things I always compliment the X-Files for is that, and if we flip back for a second to season one, you could feel them thinking, correctly so in many ways, that they had to like get through a list of famous or well-known phenomena in terms of, you know, we had a werewolf type episode, you know, we literally went through the elements. We had like an episode about fire control. We had one set in ice with ice worms, like, you know, and it was, but among the things that it's ticking through, aliens, UFOs, it creates things. It creates new creatures. It creates new cryptids that have endured to this day, where people talk about The Host and that monster. Yeah. And they've done it multiple times. They've invented other mythologies behind creatures that are inspired by some folklore, but in some areas utterly invented from nothing, or maybe a crazy headline from National Enquirer, and they just like run with it from that. But yes. Yeah, it's The Host still gives me the chills, and it's not for the reason maybe you'd expect. It's actually when they, once they have him, and we address this in the book, once he's basically in their captive, and he's on that like medical table or whatever, and he's just kind of hanging out. And Scully's like, oh my God, like, look at him and stuff. It's the fact that he's kind of a bloke. He's got all, you know, he's a non-gender specific humanoid, just like in their person. He's not hiding in the corner on the ceiling. He's not scratching around. He's just kind of there in captivity. And that's more creepy than anything to me. It's like,
it's,
oh God.
Absolute nightmare fuel. You're so right.
It's nightmare fuel. That's the phrase. Yeah.
It is, like, how this stands up after so many years, I have no idea, but it is creepy, it is ugly, it is, as you say, just left of centre of what we recognise as human, so it's just, like, otherworldly, and it's so gross, like, as you say, leechy things, parasites, oh, no.
And the shower scene, you know, the shower yes. scene where you go, oh, it's not trying to kill people, it's impregnating them with its offspring, and that poor dude showers are, you know, such a trope of horror, but again, to subvert that expectation and to have, oh no, he's a mama, he's got some babies going on the way, and it's like, oh God. It's...
This one in particular gets very Cronenberg-y. I'm going to mention also here, in my notes in capitals, is I wish Mulder would stop being a moany bitch. Now, he starts this season being so miserable. Like, I don't know how we begin to like him by the halfway point, but we do. But he's just utterly miserable and in a bad place. And like, it takes Gillian Anderson, who I believe was pregnant at the time. So they were filming her. This is again, from what I remembered from Loaded magazine of all things. Like, so they were talking about how they were filming her, or she was talking about how they were filming her from, the waist up. Like, is that true? Is that am I remembering it right? That was season two?
Yeah, it's you know, Gillian Anderson became pregnant, and then the show basically went, well they got inspired to do what became, well, the plot line as it moved forward with the mythology was basically, I can't imagine they would have come up with the mythology if they didn't have Gillian be off screen for a while, and, you know, to essentially have a baby.
Yeah.
It's a weird thought experiment to think about. If she didn't have a baby at that time, would we ever have had the mythology that began so strongly with the syndicate and then having Dwayne Barry's abduction. So yeah, it's a really, but again, this happens a lot in TV when actors become pregnant. They do, they shoot up the upper half. I guess another way they could have gone, they could have actually had her be just pregnant as a character and just had it as a normal pregnancy and own the fact that Scully was pregnant. But it definitely creates a situation where they knew that the actor would need some time away from the show, obviously, because she's going to have a baby. And I think that her absence, it's a really powerful thing because we've just got to know and love these two characters after a season and a bit of season two. And it's one of those strange serendipity things that I think that the strength of the mythology is hung on that moment. I mean, you'd never have guessed, and I don't think it's even happened now in modern TV, that one of the main two characters would be abducted and be absent from the show, that they are the top lining characters. But it creates that discombobulation as a fan. You're like, no, that can't happen. And I think what the ingenious move of it was, it raises the stakes to the point where you think, well, anything can happen to either of them. Like, there's not, and it actually increases the threat level to both characters. So when Mulder ends up being threatened, they both get threatened a bunch of times throughout the show. But you buy into it because you go, no, this was the show that did that to Scully. So I'm not, all bets are off.
I'm glad they didn't go with the, like, right, we've just had the Fluke Man episode. Scully, you're pregnant now with the Fluke Man.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine the child at school? Yeah.
That's pure Cronenberg. Yeah, that's horrible. Yeah.
No, all right. So I think if it's all right, we'll just go into the mythology here.
Sounds good.
All right, because you brought Dwayne Berry up now twice. So,
I know.
Right. Okay, so we begin the whole thing with, and we got to make it clear, with X-Files, there are these two sorts of strands of episodes. We've got the mythology-based ones, where it's all that UFO stuff and the conspiracy stuff and the cigarette-smoking man stuff and all this sort of stuff going on. And what I always remember from these episodes from season two is Skinner. Like, I don't know if I trust him. And yet here we are. I completely trust him. But no, should I trust? I love it. I love it so ambiguous. I don't know. What are you doing? And then we've got the Monster of the Week ones, which we've touched on now. So let's get into these, this otherworldly stuff. So is this where you prefer? Is this where you find yourself at ease? Or are you more of the Monster of the Week guy?
That's interesting. I think that when I look at the show as a whole, I would say that the mythology overall is the heart of the show. Actually, I would say that is where you see character development the most. You see Mulder and Scully's relationship developing the most, and the sort of war of attrition with Skinner and things like that. They tend to happen in the mythology arc. So I always say, however entertaining and wonderful the Monster of the Week episodes are, and they are fantastic, a lot of them are more self-contained and are more a closed case after that situation has happened. So the mythology for me is because it feels like the beating heart of the show. It feels like from the pilot, although the pilot you could argue is kind of its own thing about, you know, abductions and things, but it really sets the ball rolling as to the mythology moving forward with extraterrestrials. But yeah, this Dwayne Barry storyline, I can remember it happening as a fan when it went out, and it just threw everyone through a loop, all fans through, in the best way. It was the most exciting, unexpected thing. Again, the show's gonna do in its second season. We're not even like season five, we're at season two.
Hello, this is Fox Mulder. Leave a message, please.
Mulder, it's me. I just had something incredibly strange happen. This piece of metal that they took out of Dwayne Barry, it has some kind of a code on it. I ran it through a scanner and some kind of a serial number came up. What the hell is this thing, Mulder? It's almost as if... it's almost as if somebody was using it to catalog him.
Watching the ratings of this, it was incredible. They were so high for this. This was like a whole nation, like, glued to the telly watching this stuff. Yeah. I could well believe it, because as I say, I remember it much like you do, just chatting about it with friends, like, can't wait until next week. Like, Netflix weren't putting all this on in one go so you could just binge it. No, we had to wait. Okay. Absolutely. Season two, as you mentioned, really amplifies this whole mythos. Later seasons for me, I was getting a bit fed up and annoyed with the direction it was trying to take me. And I felt like at places it was getting a bit convoluted, and it wasn't the story as a fan that I wanted. But at the same time, I'm not writing the show. It's not my show. I like it or lump it. That's the way I am with the stuff that I like to watch. But here, it's exactly what I want. And it's taken me to places, like you said, that with your lead disappearing for a few episodes and being abducted, we don't know, is it by humans, is it by UFOs? It looks like it's UFOs. And then when she comes back, she's not sure, but we know what's happening with Dwayne Barry. Like, this stuff was really the best thing that could possibly be happening to a 19-year-old Paul at the time. I was just absolutely like, this is the best. I love TV. This is better than the A-Team, for goodness sake. Right. Where do you stand on all this? You've said how much you've enjoyed it. You're writing a book currently about it, or have finished, perhaps, I hope. Tell me all about, like, your thoughts on where this is going at this point in season two.
So I think the Dwayne Barry character, the Steve Railsback, amazing performance. He has to get a shout out for it. Just, he dials in every single nuance that makes him, the title character, makes him mysterious, unpredictable. You want to believe things he says, but you can see that there's an unhinged quality to him, and he's dangerous. He proves how dangerous he is. For me, just doing the storyline of Dwayne Barry at this point in the show, as a fan, this is how I responded to it. So I always use this phrase that, you know, a TV show, it sort of educates its view on how you should behave to the show. So the show has already presented to me stories of alien abductions, creatures, blah, blah, blah. Some nefarious conspiracies clearly bubbling away, because the end of season one was a complete, you know, mind-bending craziness of what happened with Deep Throat. Explore if you've not watched. So coming this early into season two, you're already kind of on shaky ground. You're already a bit discombobulated. And you're like, well, what does this mean for our characters? But crucially, Dwayne Barry comes in and says, "I'm not going to let them take me again." And you're like, "Oh, okay." And I'm going to go to some extreme lengths to make sure that they don't take Dwayne Barry again. And the hostage situation is incredibly tense. It for me, the arc is a couple of episodes and goes beyond that. But the crucial first episode of the Dwayne Barry arc, if you like, it's a great play, you know, because you've got all the tension and the subterfuge of the people who bring Mulder in. They're not telling him the full truth. They're not telling him his background, though I won't reveal all the secrets in case fans listeners want to check it out. There's some great reveals of Dwayne Barry's character that Mulder's angry about, and Mulder doesn't trust the people he works with. And this is all in the first act. You're like, this is just great TV, great drama. And he keeps saying this phrase about, you know, I won't let them take me again. And he's got this plan. I will take someone to this place. If they try and take me again, he can be my substitute. And there's absolutely no point, at any point in this episode, where you think Scully or Mulder has a situation where they're not going to be taken. It's Mulder and Scully. So the fact that Scully is taken, and it's such a traumatizing sequence, and again, you're so confused as to how he even knew where she lived. You know, like, was it a tip-off? Was it an inside job? Was it what? Were the aliens telling him, oh my God, I don't know. But all you know is, oh yeah, she gone. and what a cliffhanger for an episode, for 45 minutes of TV that goes straight into Ascension, the next episode. But it's, I just think that the power of it is, as I said, the show had brought us to this place. The show had said, here's the rules of the show. We're going to break them, but we're also going to pay off this whole notion of us looking at abduction phenomena in a completely different way and a more visceral way, because Scully's going. And you just think, I love shows that dare to do the sort of box themselves into a corner scenario. So when Scully does go, you go, how would he come back from that? What is the end result from that? So it pulls you in as a viewer. I love it.
I would love to be a fly on the wall in the writer's room when they say, right, we're going to also introduce, with all this, we're also going to introduce this character called Krycek. Oh. And like, I don't like Krycek because I want Scully back, right, from the off. But like, you know, I just feel in my heart, as soon as like Mulder's starting to get used to him and maybe even liking him a little bit, and we're starting to like Mulder again by this point, like, yeah. Okay. And then Krycek just does the unbelievable thing, and if you haven't said, I guess we are spoiling. So
we
like
spoil,
a double agent, and it's a killer. It's such a killer scene, and what a great character. And I was just thinking, there's so much going on, and then you've introduced this new element, and it's still working, and we're still as fans going, oh, what's next? Like, it's great telly, right? It's unmatched.
It is unmatched, and again, breaking the rules of TV, we've all seen things that have two-part episodes in some respects by this point, but when you have it to be continued and you go into Ascension, there's some part of you that goes, well, we need to find Scully, right? And they don't, and she's not back. Can you just, what? Again, this is pre-internet, or the just the dawn of the internet, isn't it, mid-90s, but you can't jump onto chat rooms and discuss this ad nauseum, and you can't throw around theories and things. You do feel kind of alone, and the week-to-week waiting of things, I think that's what made a show like The X-Files so daring and so rewarding, is that I do love how they made things difficult. This was a difficult mythology to track. And I think if you binged it now, I think, well, as you're doing a rewatch now, mythology in the seasons later that felt stranger, I can promise you, not saying this because of volume two of the book, but there's like a slow clap that I give to like the creatives, because they tracked it all pretty beautifully in terms of like how that mythology evolves and shifts and changes. And then there's subterfuge within the ranks, then something else comes in. But that is harder to track on a week to week basis. But the show was just confident in its MO of going, this is a challenging show. Enjoy, like, we'll figure it out. They didn't want to fax anything in. I think, by contrast, a lot of shows that fall into this space of sort of genre sci-fi, I think in some respects, I'm not going to name them, but the other shows in this space have kind of been a bit too easy, a bit too like easy to binge, and you go, well, yeah, I'm not discombobulated in an interesting way. It's all a little bit too easy to analyze and resolve. And I personally love shows that challenge me. I love mysteries that challenge me. I want to be invested in it. I want to meet the writers and directors that they're playing for, rather than feeling like I'm being spoon-fed.
That's good news to me, because I haven't gone past season four since my early 20s, so when it first was on. So that's interesting, because I remember being, as I said earlier, I wasn't disappointed, but I didn't enjoy myself as much, because the mythology just felt like mental at certain points. So I am looking forward to like having my wiser brain on me, maybe, for TV.
Well, it's just a different experience, I think. That's the crucial thing. And I think that what you'll find when you do season four, I think it's one of the best seasons of the show. It's so much going on that's incredible with the mythology, incredible Monster of the Week episodes. But there's this really, for me, there's this great domino effect that just falls through wonderfully from four into five. And five's a short season, but then you get Fight the Future. It goes straight into the movie. And then 601 picks up immediately after the movie. And that carries you through their new predicament. Mulder and Scully are in a completely different space, predicament, in season six. That once you get to the end of season six, it's like one of the most like mind-bending cliffhangers ever. That then seven, I mean, I'm just waffling now.
I can't remember now. This sounds great.
But seven is such a great season that leads towards, so eight is like, you know, the introduction of Robert Patrick as Agent Doggett, John Doggett. But what I love about eight, when you get to it, as a little tip up for anyone who's curious about the X-Files, yes, it is worth the binge, but eight is kind of like one big movie. Eight's crazy. Eight's got its own arc. Yes, there's some standalone elements to it, but eight, a lot of fans say the way that eight plays out and the way that eight ends, you could have ended the show. You could have just ended it at how eight resolves itself. And of course, we got more episodes after that. But there's a really great through line that is like a domino falling all the way through those seasons. with the movie in the middle, which is just fab. I love Fight the Future.
Yeah, yeah.
It's totally great. Taken us off the rails of season two. I do apologize.
No, it's fine. I as you were saying that, I remember an episode with the Brady Bunch. There was a Brady Bunch episode. I can't wait to get stuck back in. Anyway.
With you'll love this, if you may have forgotten this, Michael Emerson from Lost, pre-Lost, is in the Brady Bunch episode.
Oh, really? I would have no idea.
He's the main character. Yeah, he's the main character. Enjoy.
I was just going to bring up Lost, actually, because there is a moment within this mythology of season two that I remember hitting me in the same way that the rustle at the tree of the trees at the end of episode one of Lost really got me. And it brought me into the whole of like the mythos of Lost, of like, I'm going to love this. And it's when Mulder is told that his sister's back. And as a fan watching this and knowing what's happening in season one, knowing that a lot of his character and the way he is based on that, those events of his sister disappearing, it was insane. And I'm still not sure if I like the way that whole thing played out, but what balls it took to write it in that way. And to just open up avenues of thought and like, okay, you know, I feel like watching that when we know what's going on with his sister, like one of those crazy memes where you've got things on the wall and like bits of white red paper will go left, right, center. Like, this is madness. What's going on here? Tell me all about this, the whole mythology with the sister and the duplicates and cloning, because that's still a big part that starts here, right?
Yeah. So when we get into the episode Colony, we really kick into high gear of just a different sort of aesthetic and a different threat level for the show. Yeah, it's Colony into Endgame is really our first experience of the shape-shifting alien bounty hunter. And again, the show is using cutting-edge morphing technology to do that, the morphing between the actor's face and other actors. I do, if I remember correctly, don't hate me if I got it slightly wrong, I do believe that David Duchovny was really involved a lot with presenting and developing the storyline of that with Chris Carter, the writers, because it really, it pushed the show into space where there was like almost a point of no return. If we have this threat level of shapeshifters, you can just do so much with that. And what I love the most, again, I always love how it affects Mulder and Scully's relationship. There's that great moment where, you know, the alien bounty hunter is posing as Mulder and comes into a hotel room, and then Mulder calls her on her cell. And it's like, it's just like a fantastic cliffhanger of like, well, how's this going to play out? And she's seeing this with her own eyes. And she is more of a skeptic, and she doesn't believe as much immediately as Mulder does in paranormal phenomena. But it's a great situation for a character like her to be presented with, because it's like, that is Mulder. Even how her brain's processing it, it looks like Mulder. And of course, then he attacks her, and there's a skirmish, and it's amazing. And the Samantha, the character who's presented to Mulder as, oh, this is your sister, that is also then given to him in different ways, as in, oh, it was based on your sister's DNA, and the manipulation of Mulder in that situation is ever evolving on the show. And again, just audacious, man. This is like audacious storytelling that you go, so as you said, I'd love to be in the writer's room when someone puts their hand up and goes, and then we'll do this. And then what about if they both go into a river? And what if the Samantha Mulder comes out, and then her face starts melting and is like, shows this green goo, and you're like, wait, is she an experiment? Is she an alien? It's like, it's just audacious move after audacious move. And I just, I think back at those times, like you say, it's just, it's magic TV for, but again, I don't think it can be overstated. TV wasn't like this. You know, go back a decade, find an 80s show which went in this direction, which was this mythos heavy, or was this the cinematography that was this dark and smoky and eerie on a regular basis. It's not there. They're not really there. There were like moments of things, of course. You know, we can't not salute Rod Serling's incredible Twilight Zone and Night Gallery and these amazing shows, anthology shows, essentially. But as far as a through line of a genre show, which was this gripping, and like you say, as a fan, you tune in, am I going to get more of the mythology, or am I going to get a standalone this week? Oh, what's it going to be? And you don't know.
You don't know.
You can't look ahead.
I just can't believe how successful these left of center episodes were. Like I was going through old Rolling Stone articles, and it said that this episode, Colony, I think it was like just less than 20% of households in America were watching it. And like, for an episode of TV that crazed and that, like, you can't just jump in with that. Like, you can't, like, oh, I've never seen it, I'll just go and watch it. Yeah. That's crazy amount of people.
Yeah. Well, you brought up a great memory, and it's one of the Year in Horror family members, Nicky Jones. It was deserves a shout out on a regular basis. But he has an X-Files memory with me, which is that he was the friend who went with me, who agreed to go with me to see Fight the Future in the theater. But he knew of the show, but he wasn't a regular watcher of the show.
Right.
And he said, but you know what? I want to come and see it with you because I want to see if that works. Can I be thrown into this movie and understand everything? And I'll never forget it because it was a great litmus test of a mate coming along seeing something that I was so invested in and was like looking for the Easter eggs and the plot lines. And he came out and said, I loved it. And not only was it just a great science fiction movie, but I wasn't lost for a second. I got everything that was presented to me. And you just go, right on. That's really cool. So I think maybe that was the thinking with Colony, that however crazy it was, we're going to see a shape-shifting character. If you've heard a bit of buzz about the X-Files, the way the writers engineered that storyline and presented it with Mulder and Scully, you could kind of jump in and just see that these are two agents dealing with crazy, crazy stuff. And if that hooked you, maybe you jumped on board at that point and then went back and, you know, I don't know, found DVR recordings or whatever it would have been at the time, VHS yes. recordings.
Okay, so it's pretty easy to come by now. And in fact, I did a little look today and you can find like season 2 on DVD box set for like £2 or something if you go onto eBay. So you can find this stuff. It's very easy. And I think almost in any charity shop here, like you will find it. So you can watch this stuff. If you've always been like, there's so much of it, I can't be bothered. I'm going to watch something. Just give it a go. Just like we've said on the previous episode when we talked about Twin Peaks, like, just do it. Right, okay. So I'm going to ask you a ridiculous question because I know your passion for this season is huge. But if you were going to pinpoint a particular episode that you think is the best and it's your favourite, what is it and why?
I'm going to commit. I'm going to just dive in and say it's probably the season 2 finale, Anasazi, because I was listing it out. I was like, what is so great about this episode? And it's just an embarrassment of riches of what the end of season 2. And of course, I adore all the Dwayne Barry stuff. Like, this is not like a big jump between grades of episodes, but Anasazi, which ends up being a 3-part episode that's concluded in the first 2 episodes of season 3. Anasazi, end of season 2. Let's just like throw at the wall what this show now gives us in an episode. So you get this amazing, all these Native American beliefs that get presented to you related to alien mythology, which is fascinating. You see what is presented to us as kind of like, yeah, this could be an alien body, like an alien corpse in the desert, and it's an amazing special effects, amazing creature design. It's dead, but it's like it's there, and it looks incredible. Production design is amazing. You get Mulder's being drugged by who in his building? Like, Mulder's going crazy. Mulder's like freaking out and like being really violent. You're like, what's going on with Mulder? Mulder's dad turns out that he's connected somehow to the mythology, and he's talking about this mysterious phrase called the merchandise, and you're like, what is happening? The Krycek stuff, you talk about loving Krycek. Like, this is like a volume raising situation of madness, of amazement. Scully is nearly shot dead when she's in Mulder's apartment. This all happens in one episode. You know, Scully has to shoot Mulder through the shoulder to stop him killing Krycek. Yes. It's like, and then if that wasn't enough for you, dear listener, what's good TV? You see this buried train car that potentially has piles of bodies of aliens that look like maybe they've had some kind of smallpox injection on their arm.
Yeah.
I mean, it might sound like word salad that I just threw out right there, but I think what I threw out there is evidence that this is one of the greatest 45 minutes of TV the X-Files threw out there.
And you forgot to mention that in the very opening, we've got that awesome 90s trope of we've got a hacker that gets into the Central Intelligence Agency. It's so good. I love it.
Forgot that. Yeah. The thinker. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, what to say about that episode? And like we talk about cliffhangers. Like, I've recently, for something else on this channel, have started watching the Batman serials. And they depend on cliffhangers. And yet, I know it's old, but it's nothing compared to this. I can't imagine what it was like. And I was there. I can't fathom like what I was feeling. To be left there for a season and have to wait for another season... It's ridiculous. You can't do that. And like as I said to you yesterday, like myself and my wife, we watched this particular episode yesterday, and then after our chat yesterday, we then watched the finale without realizing. Oh, there's another episode after it. God damn it! Still not finished. Like this is bizarre storytelling, and they totally get away with it.
Yeah, totally do. It's. I think it's really. You know, any show that takes things from, let's just say, mysticism, religious beliefs, folklore, whatever is actually down in paper, in books about the history of things, if you can take components from that and then twist them ever so slightly in a kind of like twistery of history and embellish and add your own mythos to things, I think that's when things get really fascinating, because then as a show, you're being daring and saying, we're a TV show. I'm not saying this is 100% the truth. I'm not saying we have to honor this. It's a documentary, but we can just bend it ever so slightly to our own ends of what the syndicate are up to, what the conspiracy is up to. But again, we talked about this earlier, grounding it in a degree of realism and grounding it in something which people can latch onto. And these days you could do a Google about the Anasazi and go, oh, there was some interesting connections there. Back in the day, you couldn't. You kind of took it on face value. But it's what I really love about this too is in looking ahead slightly into how the episodes progress and resolve themselves, you present Mulder with a spiritualism that he's not really used to being around, because he's not, you know, Scully's the woman of faith, Mulder's not the man of faith. And I think that the show is at its best when it does that, when it gives one of those two characters an opposite situation to try and deal with, where it's really happening, dude. And yeah, you were kind of dead and you were kind of saved by these Native Americans. And how do you want to process that, huh? You know, it's like, it's also, it's wonderfully messy. That's what I call it, storytelling. It's great.
Right. I think we should end it here. Paul, thank you so much for coming back on.
Man, thank you so much. It's always a treat being on You in Horror. And if you want me to talk X-Files, I mean, what are you doing? That's like, you just serve me up a cup of tea and a slice of cake. I'm never going to push that away. That's some good stuff. That's a good day well spent.
Well, there you have it. The plan now is to have each season of The X-Files documented over on Patreon, and myself and Paul Terry, we're going to be doing that over the next couple of years. I hope he's going to join me for every single series of this. I think he knows them a lot better than me. But for now, let's dip back into the chart.